Hey Denise, thank you for coming in. My, what a wonderful career you have, and you're so young, and you've done so much. It's just simply remarkable. Like you're a full professor at one of the top universities in the world, and you're a founding faculty member of this Experiential Robotics Institute. You've done so many contributions with an IEEE and so much more. I mean, there's the International Committee of the Robotics Arms Control. I mean, it's just the list goes on. The Institute for Economics and Peace, and you write for Nature. Nature is like one of the premier publications, vetted publications in the world today, and it just continues. And you've been leading continuing delegations for AI for Good, which is really the largest sustainable development AI summit and program in the world today. It just continues and continues and continues. So thank you for coming in and sharing your insights with our audience.
Even it's an honor to be here with you, and I look forward to being with you in Geneva for AI for Good 2023.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. And hearing that you were there in 2018 and 2019, and now you're going to be there for 2023. So that's just absolutely wonderful.
Even I'll be there with a petite entourage of 23 young people plus 3 alumni. So we are going to be a big group walking around and looking to see you. Looking forward to seeing you.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. Now, Denise, my audience, actually, there's a large number of investors and CEOs in my audience, and even people from government funds, by the way, together with scientists and practitioners and engineers. Because it's so mixed, they're always curious. You know, when I interview somebody with this wonderful life that you have and wonderful career, what were those magic inflection points that made this amazing progress that you've had and will continue to make it in the world? You know, and it could have been something that happened when you were very young. Could have been mentors you've had, or maybe inflection points in your career. What are those magic moments that you want to share with our audience?
Stephen, I grew up in Brazil during the dictatorship. Uh-huh. And in the first 10 years of my life during the dictatorship, there was a lack of everything, right? Including books and access to knowledge. But there was plenty of violence, armed violence. So that marked my life tremendously. And eventually after Brazil, after college, well, the other inflection moment was having met Antonio Augusto Cansado Trindade. He unfortunately just passed in May, and he was one of the judges of the International Court of Justice. And he was my professor at the University of Brasília. So he said, go to Geneva and study there at the University of Geneva at the Graduate Institute of International Studies and Development. And I did. I followed his advice. And my research there, Stephen, eventually led to a PhD that eventually led me being part of the Harvard Global World Peace Foundation. And I wrote the first book that linked small arms and security. So the idea of having the tools of violence controlled by international law and using international law to bring nations together to cooperate on this issue of arms proliferation was a blind spot in world politics until the very first meetings that happened leading up to 2001. And I was part of everything in Geneva, being a student there, for having followed Antonio Augusto Cansado Trindade's advice to me in embracing international law as my main area of study, Stephen, and writing this book at Harvard at the World Peace Foundation under Professor Robert Rothberg. And I think being at Harvard was that other inflection point, being under his mentorship and working on this book that then led to other projects on peace and security, linking arms and controlling arms.
So that's really fascinating. I can see the sort of history within South America and that sort of shaping your view and your worldview as well, leading to then further studies in Geneva and then at Harvard, and then the different mentors that you had in Brazil to Geneva to Harvard, really shaping what you're doing today. And you're so involved in ensuring that there's going to be the useful, peaceful applications of technology. And that's why you're involved with the IEEE programs in this way. So can you talk more now about what you're doing today and the different communities? For example, in the IEEE, you know, you're the vice chair of the International Committee on the Robotics Arms Control. You're a member of the Ethics Initiative on the Ethics of Autonomous Intelligent Systems. You know, what is the purpose of that work? And then we'll get into the Toyota Peace Institute in Tokyo and things like that. So talk about this IEEE side. And to the audience, the IEEE is the world's largest technology engineering organization in the world. It's been around for over, in some shape, for over 154 years. So.
Right, Stephen. It has been an honor to be involved in being a member of the IEEE. Now in my, I think, third year of as a member, and having participated at their first meeting in person back in Philadelphia in May 2022, that was an absolute excitement for me as well. But it always started, Stephen, because I was part of the International Panel for the Regulation on Autonomous Weapons. And that is an initiative that started in 2017 by the government of the former Chancellor Angela Merkel. So she, her Minister of Foreign Affairs, put together 25 experts from around the world to start thinking about international regulatory frameworks for autonomous weapons. And we would be then become an advisory board for the ongoing conversations at the United Nations in Geneva on autonomous weapons. And a couple of the members of this panel, Stephen, especially Peter Azzaro from the New School in New York, he was part of the IEEE ethics process, ethics conversations, and the reports that were seminal in advising the whole of the international community on ethics in autonomous systems and artificial intelligence systems. And then I became involved in that. That eventually brought the creation of a small group of 10 people led by Ariel Cole within IEEE to create the first report on autonomous weapons. And Steve, the International Committee for Robot Arms Control is an epistemic community, you know, very interdisciplinary. We are all over the world. We have a vast membership. And we meet whenever is important to meet, whenever we're seizing the moment to have an impact, but it's always a little bit behind the scenes as well. So, which is, I think, very important sometimes to work behind the scenes and talk to a broadest array of stakeholders possible.
So there's this conjunction of working on these programs with regards to regulation of autonomous weapons and sort of the ethical sides of all of this as well. But you're also on the research board of the Toyota Peace Institute. How did that come about?
Right, Steve. So as I told you, the World Peace Foundation and the Interstate Conflict Program at Harvard back then, with Professor Robert Rothberg, that brought me to the world of peace studies and world peace and that scholarship of linking peace and conflict resolution as well. So the Toyota Peace Institute came because I had a meeting with Kevin Clements, and he was at the Institute for Economics and Peace in Sydney, like me, as part of the research board. So Kevin Clements invited me to come be part of the Toyota Peace Institute Board of Research and International Counselors. And that has been an absolute honor as well. Steve, again, a lot of backstage conversations, which I enjoy doing, you know, and having a chance to also being in Tokyo as well and meeting leaders, especially from the Southeast Asia region as well, very important right now to be talking peace. So the link between the Institute of Economics and Peace, which is longer for me, Stephen, I have been part of the Institute for Economics and Peace in Sydney since 2014. So Toyota came more recently, but these two communities, being in Sydney and being in Tokyo, there are a lot of bridges between them. And a lot of the work is very exciting. So I started thinking about these concepts of humanity's security that I include in my current book that is going to be launched soon, and all these ideas of common good governance that align very well as well with AI for good.
And there's also the Nobel Peace Institute fellow in Oslo in 2017, right? So tell us about that.
Stephen, that was definitely an inflection point as well in my life. And I was deeply honored to be part of that community of peace as well. So one of my best friends at Northeastern University is Professor Maya Cross, and she was the first Nobel Peace Research Institute fellow back in 2016. And she nominated me to be the following one, also from Northeastern. So I was there in 2017. I had the pleasure of living in Oslo for a few months, Stephen, which I will never forget. What an interesting society Norway is. I remember arriving in Oslo, dropping my bags, and walking up to His Majesty's palace in the park. I saw he had his flag flying, so I knew he was there. And I approached the palace, and I was expecting a gate or soldiers guarding it. There was nothing. There were no gates, no fences. And I knew he was there. Very few guards. And then I wandered around the park, and there was a sign saying, "Hug the trees, relax, this park is yours." So that marked me a lot, Stephen, you know, being in a society that is, by and large, very equal, very exciting for equality and these ideas of peace. So no wonder why the Nobel Peace Prize is emanating from that city, Oslo. So that was a very, very exhilarating, very invigorating moment of my career. And these ideas of common good governance, how can we create global public goods of great interest for humanity, started emerging there while I was there.
You've done two articles for Nature, and you have this continuing relationship with Nature. And Nature is such a prestigious publication. And the one in 2020 was on redirecting military budgets to tackle climate change and pandemics. And you talk about that one. And then the second one was in 2021, which is Stop the Emerging AI Cold War. And there'll be others as well. So Can you kind of profile that first article and the second article and more to come?
Of course, Stephen. First of all, it was an absolute honor to work with Nature, with the editors in particular, who work the process of peer review, and they themselves are involved in the peer reviewing process. That was an incredibly exciting process for me, and I learned a lot from them. So I'm very thankful to them, to the editors at Nature. But Stephen, what happened with the first article in 2020? Well, I had planned my research sabbatical, which is an opportunity that I have as a research faculty every few years, just to do research, not do any teaching or any service, just for 6 months or a year. And I had planned the sabbatical for 2020. I had aligned all these trips and events that I was going to do in Geneva, in Tokyo, in Sydney. And everything came crashing down because of the pandemic. So I remember I was in Sydney in February 2020, and I was there hosted by the Institute for Economics and Peace, and also Professor Toby Walsh, who is one of the leading AI scholars who actually started this movement of letters to the public warning against the perils of weaponizing AI back in 2015. So I was there with Professor Toby Walsh, with the Institute of Economics and Peace, and I had to escape in one of the last flights outbound from Sydney and come back to Boston because the world was closing. And Stephen, what I realized was that as states, as countries were erecting borders and playing on their nationalistic instincts, shying away from global cooperation, the scientists were shedding their borders. They were cooperating as much as possible. Chinese with Swedish, with Brazilian, with American science, no matter nationality, they were really trying to decipher the code of the virus and try to get to the vaccines as promptly as possible. And I realized, well, here we are, right? I started immediately getting into looking at the data. I signed up for Science for Nature, so I could receive them in my house, not only access from our library, but also getting them in my hands and looking at the data. And I started realizing that, Stephen, as you remember very well, the biggest major military powers, they were the ones that probably suffered with the highest numbers of casualties. They were somehow visibly the least prepared for the pandemic. So I realized, wow, why build up so much and why spend $2 trillion a year, which is the global military output expenditure according to CPRI, which is the most authoritative data for military expenditures. Why spend $2 trillion a year, which was sustained in the following year, 2021, if you can't be ready to tackle a pandemic? So the idea for the first article for Nature came along about that time. So where I realized, you know, we need to be ready for the threats that affect all of humanity, and they're not necessarily military threats. So I worked with Nature, I pitched the idea for the article, and then I worked with the editors. And after that, Stephen, the idea for the second article came, which, well, I realized again that, we, you know, as the pandemic was unfolding towards an end, we're not to an end yet, but countries were, again, spending every year another $2 trillion on military, and already in the process of arming, militarizing, and weaponizing AI. So this idea of the AI Cold War, the military AI race, the AI military race that I talk about in my book, became an initial idea in the second article at Nature.
So, you know, quite remarkable. And you've been alluding to this book multiple times. So let's talk about your book. So tell us about the book.
Stephen, the book has been a very exciting journey in my life. So this is my third book, and I met the most extraordinary people along the way. So Stephen, it always starts, really the first ideas, you know, it starts all in 2014, when I was present in the very first meeting ever at the UN in Geneva, where states come together and start talking about autonomous weapons. So that was May 2014. And then I was already part of the International Committee for Robot Arms Control. And then a few years later, I became part of this Chancellor Angela Merkel's Minister of Foreign Affairs panel on autonomous weapons in Berlin. So we started meeting in Berlin every 3 months from 2017. Advising the conversations at the UN as they were progressing. And I realized with the conversations in Berlin, we would also talk to the European Union, with NATO, Geneva, New York, UN Geneva, UN in New York. And I realized gradually, Stephen, we needed to create, of course, a new international treaty on autonomous weapons, right? And the idea of that treaty was discussed throughout those years, this new treaty. And eventually, Stephen, with the input from many parts of global society, but the International Committee of the Red Cross, I think, was a very important input. The people from the ICRC, advising which shape that treaty should take. And we realized that the AI conversation started to emerge within these conversations at the UN in Geneva. So I said, the idea for the book came together. I had written a few articles about, a few peer-reviewed articles, but I said the book became in full shape in 2018, more or less. And I started writing it and meeting people and really, so the autonomous weapons process, Stephen, is part of the book, and the treaty remains elusive. Of course, we don't have an international treaty yet controlling, regulating, and banning certain types of autonomous weapon systems. And meanwhile, you have, you know, of course, diplomacy being completely outpaced by technology, as usual, as you know, better than I. So, of course, we are in a race of diplomatic talks continue. But, of course, the developments, especially in AI and AI-assisted autonomous systems that have become increasingly more common, is, of course, still something that the international community will have to deal with. So the book argues for the prospects of deterioration of the international legal frameworks that we have under international law, human rights law, international criminal law, international humanitarian law, which are the laws of war. All that is at risk of being weakened by this fast pace of the utilization of autonomous systems that threaten human dignity. And then I argue the book offers perhaps a warning for countries along the scientists' warning. So I followed all that the scientists have been doing in the last years, all their letters, all their meetings, the AI scientists that have been warning against the perils of weaponizing this set of technologies known as AI. So the book is offers this parallels as well, Stephen, with having weaponized nuclear technology before, and then states having created nuclear weapons. But the most exciting, I think, you know, for me as a researcher, Stephen, was basically delving deep into previous global successes of cooperation in several areas, including ocean law, protecting the ozone layer, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, all these successes where states really came together and solved great perils for humanity. And I took elements from all these previously existing stories, and I of course offered a new global regulatory framework for AI, for military AI.
You're in the process, so you completed this book and it's going to be released, and you did a lot of research over a number of years, and really a culmination of all of this work that you've been doing for a long, long time at a global scale. And that's encompassed with this framework that you're proposing in this book. And yet at the same time, really literally just over a few months, you've had this release of foundation models, of which generative AI, ChatGPT is an example of just one, but you have Palm 2 and Bard from Google. You have these open source ones like Alpaca and Vicuna and so on. You have these sort of automation kind of capabilities with LangChain or something called Hugging Face or AutoGPT. And the open source models that are out there can almost do what the really, really large ones that are being produced by big tech, but at a fraction of the cost, right? You know, to train one of these large models, it's estimated it's over $100 million, but it's estimated that Vicuna was, let's say, about $300, and it you can do it on a laptop, right? So, and it's out there in the wild. It's available to anybody.
Right.
And there's all of these emerging capabilities that are coming out, right? So if you string this idea of a chain of thought, prompting to reflection, to self-consistency, to tree of thought, and doing this kind of process supervision. These papers are just coming out on a continuing basis where you're getting more and more accuracy and just more and more capability. And with the automation parts that are being released as well, what does that say? Because you've written a book on this area, and this has just come out. And it's, in fact, there's two letters that have come out, right? One signed initially by over 1,000 indicating we're concerned. You have Jeffrey Hinton out of Canada leaving Google and coming out and even saying maybe it's even more efficient at learning. And really people should look at Google, at Jeffrey's exact comments. Well, my interpretation is he's thinking that maybe even more efficient at learning than even a human. With our 100 trillion synapses. And then this recent a document coming out, signed now by others, including people in, from corporations, saying, you know, we need to do something about this because it could represent some kind of bigger problem, even bigger, some are saying, even climate change, right? So I like your view about all of this, and it's coming after you've already written the drafts of your book, right?
Yes. Stephen, the book is now in the able hands of the production team at Oxford University Press. And I would not have a chance to include any of those developments anymore. So I feel a little bit frustrated, but Stephen, all that I say in the book has gained an emergency. You know, it's urgent now. The urgency is there. So everything that I argue for, that we need to have global cooperation, we need to create global public goods, such as a new regulatory framework on military AI and a broader regulatory framework on AI that we don't have yet. We're very far from it. We must do this now. So one of the things I did is I delved into the literature of global catastrophic risks. And the literature on global catastrophic risks says there are a few risks that are urgent, right? Climate change, nuclear warfare, pandemics, and super AI. So the book has covered that, which is exciting. It gives the theoretical and the literature frameworks on how that has been thought out by this emerging literature. And then, Stephen, I also surveyed the emergence of this movement, the AI for Good, that you were one of the founding people. So I traced that in the book, and along with the scientists' perspectives and the scientists' push for regulation. And it all comes together to confirm, Stephen, that we need to have states, nations come together. Right now, I understand the geopolitics is quite complicated, but we are at a moment of extreme peril. We are at a moment where we have a lot of insecurity created by climate change, how that links to areas of the globe that are ungovernable or ungoverned. In here in our hemisphere, we have a major area that seems to be ungovernable, ongoing conflict. Many areas around the globe in Africa and Southeast Asia. So I would say, Stephen, and I would actually have the temptation to ask you, so the emergency of global cooperation, we can start by saying, let's do that. Let's pave the way to broader cooperation by engaging with the positive uses of AI, sustainable development goals, paving the way for implementing them. It's urgent that we implement the 17 goals. So what would you say, Stephen? Shall we use the AI for Good platform to show the emergency of tackling all this, of acting upon all this, since the technology is again fast outpacing diplomacy?
You know, that's a fascinating point. And in fact, when I had my initial discussion with some of the leaders within the ITU and proposed this idea of AI for social good in 2016, but earlier in the UN prior to 2015 and 2010, and even leading up to the Millennium Development Goals, this idea of ethical use was always at the forefront. And ensuring that it doesn't get out of control, ensuring that you know we have accountability, responsibility, transparency, security, privacy, safety, all of these things, and embedded into even standards that are out there. So behind the scenes, in my neck of the woods, I've also been working on this as well for many years on sort of the ethical side. And, but not just to AI, but to all technology. So I would say yes, absolutely. And it's been embedded really within the program. since the initiation of the ideas of this program called AI for Good, with hosted by the ITU, and then continuing with the ongoing programs. And we have a daily platform called the Neural Network Platform, which is an engagement. It has content and resources, the daily programming. We have an innovation factory, and we have these 9 focus groups working on the application in a safe way of AI for Good. And then the ethical aspects have always been part of this, and having that conversation and working groups on this. So, but it's become more pronounced, right? Because of the release of these foundation models, of which some people are calling generative models. Well, generative models are even bigger than large language models, because generative models can produce synthetic data and things like that, right? So, so what are the implications of all of that, and how do we manage that? I would say, Denise Garcia, and the work that you've done, you've laid the framework. You've been talking about this. You're saying that we need global cooperation. So really, people should be listening to you because you've thought about it, and you've been gelling this into something that's concrete and can be operationalized. And it's beyond just principles. We can talk forever about principles, right? You need something exactly. Concrete that we can then implement, right? So,
yes. So
I think the work you're doing is amazing. I think it's amazing that you're going to be at AI for Good. Are you meeting up with Reinhardt and Doreen and some of the others at AI for Good?
I hope so. I'd love that. We're all going to be very exciting to meet them again and meet you. And Stephen, as you were saying these last sentences so eloquently, what came to my mind was one of the cases that I studied, and I'm looking at it now because I have a huge global world map here. The Antarctica is a region that is of extreme importance, right, for the planetary system, the planetary health. And this is a region that is governed by a handful of international treaties under international law that created this region of peace and scientific exploration, where scientists are there. More recently, a few maritime protection zones were created there in the Ross Sea, which is on the eastern part of Antarctica. So there we go. We have a very clear example of what can be done when nations come together and get rid of their claims for national jurisdiction, for territorial occupation, right? And they say, we can cooperate, right? In outer space as well, we see elements of that, right? The astronaut being a friend for all humanity, and the ideas of non-weaponization of certain areas of the globe, the idea of the global commons. So, Stephen, what I thought in the book is AI as a common, as a global common. Mm-hmm. So we have the global commons, right? We have the Antarctica, we have outer space, we have the atmosphere, the high seas, which is an area that I love in my international law class. We're always studying ocean law. And why not make AI as a humanity-made common, and draw concretely from principles to concrete action, as you suggested as well, right?
Yeah. So all of the precedent is there. It's just a matter of execution, right? Taking action. So
yes.
So let's now. What do you think the world's going to look like in 2025, which is only 2 years from now, and then 2030 at the completion of the SDGs, right? When they're, the time period of the SDGs. And then let's even go further out, or can you even go further out beyond 2030, because change is happening so quickly, right? So
quickly. So I think we have enough data to concretely say that AI can be used for the great good of humanity, right? I think we have evidence of that, and we should not let, at this inflection point we are with the example of ChatGPT and the many others that you just put forward for us, we cannot let anything derail us. We have to keep our eye on the big reward. Sivai, I have to say, I am optimistic, but the next 2-3 years will be hard for humanity. I think we're gonna see more conflicts. As I look at the Ecological Threat Registry report from the Institute of Economics and Peace, when I look at the hard data of the Global Peace Index, peace has deteriorated dramatically now this year to the lowest point in 15 years. We have countries with high ecological risk threats now. But I think as humans, we have the capacity to think long term. And I think if we have 2 or 3 years of harsh realities of climate, the climate chaos that is upon us, and we have this moment of tackling what AI is posing to us as challenges and the other sets of technologies within AI. But we have to think about what is, I think, beyond that, the ability of scaling up the use of technologies for good. And I'm thinking of, we are in the midst of a green revolution, right? We are phasing out the use of coal. We are phasing out the use of harmful technologies. So I am hopeful for the decade after this one. I'm hopeful that we can reap the benefits of the Sustainable Development Goals, as we did for the Millennium Development Goals, Stephen, that halved poverty, right? But maybe, so we need to capitalize, I think, on what's going to happen at the United Nations in the next 2 years. So the current Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, who in my view is a phenomenal Secretary General, very, very exciting. He really speaks truth to power. He conceived this idea of the summit of the future in 2024, and the idea that we need to reform the United Nations and strengthen it and make it up to date to these new challenges, such as AI, such as climate change, such as the need to prevent the next pandemics, because nothing was in the UN Charter. The UN Charter is an instrument that is of 1945, and it's not being updated since. So I think we are at this moment, Stephen, that we all crave for reform, for multilateralism to be effective. And I remember, Stephen, when the UN turned 75, just a couple of years ago, the Secretary General ran a crowdsourcing world planetary survey asking people from everywhere in the world. And the pandemic was picking up, so there were lots of Zoom conversations, and people could speak more freely as well in countries where they could not do so otherwise. So the results of this planetary survey, which was the largest ever, were very encouraging, Stephen. Most people want peace. They do not want war. They do not want their countries to continue to grow their military. Growing their military for what? To tackle which threats? To tackle just the threat of war? What about all the other threats? So if we look at, I think, the data from people, this people-generated data that the UN has gathered in the last years, and it's gathering now again for the Summit of the Future, which means involving youth and what youth wants, I think I'm very optimistic.
You know, there's so many different sort of concepts that you brought forward, right? So you talk about the United Nations, which is this entity, and it's has its own governance system as well, but yet intersects with countries and companies and so on, and NGOs. And then you actually have the business community, and there's many CEO-led organizations, and they're trying to address these in different ways. You have the academic community, of which IEEE is one, ACM, Association of Computing Machinery, is another, IFIP is another, the International Federation for Information Processing, which are more computing related, but there's others as well, right? And you have foundations, which are also operating separately in essence, and yet will cooperate, but and yet they're in silos. So when I'm with the UN communities, I don't see them really understanding the academic communities as well as the business community, as well as the foundation communities. And when I'm in the business community, I don't see them understanding these other communities. Each community really understands their tribe the best and don't necessarily fully understand the other tribes. So how do we get them to all think of us as one earth tribe?
I love this. Steve, you know, as a Brazilian, I have visited the Amazon forest many times. It's one of the most special places on earth. And the idea of tribes and the tribes that manage to protect their land, their tract in the forest, like the Kayapós, is very special to me. So when you say tribe, I'm all for it. And the tribes that have the power of promoting change locally, right? Steve, so one thing that came to mind is the rise of climate litigation. So under international law, you have cases that have grown exponentially in the last 5 years where people took justice in their own hands to fight for their governments to tackle climate change. So you, after the forest fires in Australia in 2019 and 2020, you have the bushfire survivors that created this whole movement to get the Australian government to tackle climate change properly. And concomitantly, I see a rise of the larger role of the business community. So, Stephen, at Northeastern, I asked for us at Northeastern to have the observer status at the climate summits every year. It's not an integral part of my research, but I love to be there and I love to every year and to take students, but more often than not, other colleagues who are in the climate research area, they go and we are there represented with other very special universities as well, very exciting universities. So in one of the latest climate summits, Stephen, the one in Glasgow in 2022, there was this, the creation of the Global Financial Alliance for Net Zero, the Glasgow and then Global Financial Alliance for Net Zero. And that's the idea of really greening capitalism, of creating the means and the tools for the business community, banks, insurance, et cetera, to be a part of the solution. And I would argue to you, Stephen, that without the business communities, and communities in plural, we can't tackle climate change. Because most governments have no financial capacity to do so, no legal capacity, the wherewithal, the technical. So the frameworks that are created by the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, and then the 2015 Paris Agreement, and the review annual summits every year with the climate summits, creates the mechanisms for technological exchange, for financial exchange, the creation of the Green Fund that countries need to put more in. And the global business communities are essential for all this, to replenish these funds, to create the capacity and the financial wherewithal for countries that are least capable to tackle climate change. Stephen, so in my book, I created the concept of transnational networked cooperation. So transnational networked cooperation, which is the cooperation that happens within these networks that you mentioned. And you mentioned the exact communities that I talk about in the book. The groups, the scientific groups, the business communities, the social activists, the academics. And this is, I think, essential, Stephen, because when we see a dearth of a lack of cooperation amongst the major powers now, I still see a lot of cooperation that is happening across these different communities. And that I think is growing and is very energizing. Steve, I don't know if any example came to mind as you are involved in building bridges amongst these communities, if any concrete example came to your mind or examples that we could think about together leading up to the AI for Good Summit and talk to the students as well.
I was invited to keynote a group headquartered out of Denmark. It's the Danish Management Society. I think it's about 4,000 CEOs and leaders. At that time, there were maybe 4 to 5 years in actually addressing the SDGs and very much aligning with the SDGs, and had about 600 or no, about 800, I would say, use cases that they were sharing internally. And they invited me to keynote to them internally because they were quite mature, and yet they wanted to be even do more so. So they would be a CEO community that would very much support what you're doing. There's another community called YPO, and I chair an advisory board with them, and there's an impact community within the YPO. And in fact, within the YPO impact community, they have a peace action network. And a network by YPO definitions is typically at least 750 CEOs or more.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that network be very aligned with what you're doing. But the YPO community is, in my opinion, probably the world's largest private notable CEO community. They do about 10 trillion in annual revenue. They're in something like 145 countries. They have over 400 chapters. Excuse me. And they have their own private Global Impact Summit. In fact, we held it in Costa Rica in February this year, and we're going to do another one next year. And the reason I know this, because I'm actually external to them, and they invited me a number of years ago to try to help as they moved in this impact journey. So that's why I chair this advisory group to them. And so there's a group within that called the Impact Network Council. They have four impact networks within that council, one on planet and peace and sustainable business and so on. And definitely very much aligned with what you're trying to do. There's another group called Leaders on Purpose, which I'm also connected with. And in fact, I helped them with their annual summit at the UNGA last year. They're formed by a group of leaders who used to lead a program with Unilever, the World Bank, and so on, trying to identify multinationals that were really well into their purposeful journey. And what you're doing would very much resonate with them. And so they're in the process of doing another UNGA CEO summit this year in New York in September. YPO will be doing something similar as well in September. So those are two communities that would be very much supportive of what you're doing. There's another group of CEOs I work with, led by the CEO Leadership Alliance, and they're now working with a national talent collaborative with 25 other CEO leadership groups around the U.S. Elements of what you're working on, and we have an AI initiative. So again, there'll be some cohesion and support with what you're doing. In addition, there's a group of CEOs led by DTGO, which is a corporation founded by Kun Thipaporn and her partner, Kun Tan, of Team Bimita Global. They're actually part of the CP family. And that CP family, together with them and within their family group, I think they have something like 22 conglomerates. So within that would be the largest, like they have the largest stake in the largest pharmaceutical company in the world, or one of the largest in the world, the largest insurance company in the world, largest food companies in the world, the largest development companies in the world, some of the largest media companies in the world. They have founded and launched their metaverse programs, but are the essence of those programs are for the benefit of humanity, all life, and for goodness.
Right.
And so, again, very much aligned with what you're doing. And so I support them and their work, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm just brainstorming. So there's a number of leader groups, very, very much intimately aligned with what you've done. There was a private working group of leaders within the World Health Organization during the pandemic, I was part of that small working group, but the International Chamber of Commerce was there, the International Organization of Employers, representing somewhere between 40 to 60 million businesses, leaders within the World Economic Forum were there, and so on. So, and then there's foundations, the foundation community. In terms of finance, the total financial capability now of the world is about $500 trillion. And about 80 trillion of that is held in the ultra high net worth and high net worth community, which is about 30 million. And a significant portion of that ultra high net worth or high net worth community is very much interested in now the benefit of humanity and also life on the planet. And tracking things like the demographic shifts, as you're aware, the Alpha generation, let's say those born post 2012, Generation Z or Z born post 1997, very much interested in the preservation and sustainability, right, as a demographic shift. But then you have these global demographic realities where Africa is very young, India is very young, but other parts of the world are aging, right? And so how do you manage those areas? So in answer to your question, yeah, there'd be so many different groups that I don't know if you're connected with them, but you definitely should be connected with them because they would support what you're doing easily. So
I love it, Stephen. I love, this is so energizing. You and I should write an article together about the power of networked cooperation and the power of this trans-societal and interdisciplinary multi-societal groups that can bring together major changes. We can't count on governments only anymore. Of course, this is now the reality is completely different for cooperation, for global cooperation indeed. Stephen, the other concept I bring in the book is humanity security. So this moves us away from national security, which is for me completely outdated. Human security, which is a concept that emerged in the 1990s after the Cold War. We should be thinking in planetary terms and how to scale up all these initiatives, for example, that you just mentioned as well. Humanity security struck me as I was here in Boston during the pandemic, and my parents were still unvaccinated in Brazil because of the delayed actions of the government at the time in Brazil that was delaying the purchase of vaccines for the population there. And I said, well, my security here is connected to the security of my parents, that is connected to the security of everybody else in the globe. So the pandemic made very evident that security is an idea that is humanity large. It's not about the boundaries of one country. So all that you just told me, Stephen, just comes to prove all that these groups that have this planetary impact and can reach so many different populations at so many different levels, they have enormous power right now.
Yeah, and then that goes beyond the sort of parochial tendency of humans to be thinking more very much inclusive, and that we are a global community and in the same condition of addressing some of the things that are almost existential for the entire humanity, but it's not just humanity, thinking broader than that, all life. And so thinking about for the benefit of humanity and all life in all Earth ecosystems, because everything is connected, is this idea of chaos theory, right? The flap of the wings of a butterfly somewhere affects climate in some other region of the world, but it's truly connected. And I know because I sit across so many different communities that there's a tendency for people to be very siloed in their thinking, but you can't, no longer. Everything is connected. Something that you think doesn't influence you impacts you in a profound way. Even things like the unlocking of the permafrost, and you know, there's ancient viruses now being released, and you know, what is the impact of that? The ice shelves are collapsing. What is the impact of that? The 1.5 degrees centigrade is happening now in certain regions, and people are thinking that's just short term, but at least in the security groups I work with, we think that that's, and it's much sooner, it's happening much faster, and it's escalating, right? So how do you get everybody to come together? And that's what you're trying to do. In your book, you're saying we've got to come together. You can't think in these little isolated groups, right?
Yes, Steven, I think without nature, we don't have anything. So we need nature-based solutions. If we have the collapse of parts of the Antarctica and parts of Iceland, of Greenland, then we are in deep trouble. Right. So the idea of what is the biggest threat to some of the major powers, it's not each other, it's the collapse of humanity. It's the collapse of humanity as a result of the climate chaos that is upon us. So Steve, the other group that is, I think, essential at this moment in leading us in these uncharted waters, literally, is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. It has a small secretariat in Geneva, and for me, we should hear them, right? And in preparation for the next climate summit, Steve, they already released their report, which is alarming, but it has lots of guidance on how states can act, and not only states, but all these other groups that are essential. And the next summit will be hosted by the United Arab Emirates. It's going to be held in Dubai. And again, I have great hope there, as it is in that city, that these networks of the businesses, communities from everywhere will be getting together there. Stephen, finally, on that point, I teach international law at Northeastern, the course international law that attracts people from all over the university, engineers, economists, philosophers, musicians, so many people are interested in learning the basics of international law, which is this code, right, that is older than any of the constitutions of any country that has been evolving with humanity. And for the first time this semester, Stephen, we talked about the rights of nature, which is an emerging area in international law. As you mentioned, the rights of all living things. So do these enormous trees in California, right? These beautiful redwoods, do they have rights, right? Do lakes have rights? Does the ocean have rights? So we talked about this it was hard for me because this is an emerging area in international legal studies. And I see as the cutting edge now, we have to think about the rights of all living things and all things that sustain human life.
Yeah, and not to think that humans are at the pinnacle. We're just one small little atomic part of this massive ecosystem, each of which plays an important role. Each requires this mentality of inclusion and respect, right? So, there's so many different areas. I'm just thinking, brainstorming with you. You should connect with James Bullock at the University of California, Irvine. They've created this program called Solutions That Scale. So what's happened is the entire university, all 14 schools of that university, including the student population, and the university is itself, its own energy grid and transportation system, they've all come together to say, we want to address as an entire community, entire school, the academics and the students, all the research institutes, into addressing climate and food and so on.
And I love this.
It's the only university I know of that it's done in its entirety, saying we're going to model this as an entire city, in essence, and then look to address all of these issues that are happening out there. And it has to be interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary. You can't do it alone, right? So you should connect with them. I could do an introduction. I know.
I would be honored to, Steve. I would love that, because that, Steve, aligns very well with what we're doing at Northeastern at different levels as well. Our president, Joseph Aoun, is very much a visionary in that area, our ideas of humanics, and the idea of our Experiential Robotics Institute, created by my friend, Professor Tashkin Padir, is that interdisciplinary is the only way out. And we have these majors. You will see my students in Geneva, computer science with mathematics, physics, and music. You know, it's all this interdisciplinarity that is needed right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And then respect for all, right? Everybody has a place. So yeah, we're down to our last question here. And Denise, you know, what recommendations would you want to leave to the audience? In addition to that, maybe there's some additional thoughts that you want to present to the audience. So you have the floor for the last comments and the recommendations.
Thank you so much, Stephen. I would borrow a sentence that you used. Humans are not at the pinnacle. We're just part of something much larger than us. So my recommendation is governments should not have their priorities misplaced at this moment, which I'm afraid they have. Governments should have their priorities placed for securing the security of their own citizens, which has to be aligned with the security of all humanity. The urgency of creating global public goods is enormous right now. And we can only do that with cooperation that is transnational, it's networked, it's from everyone. The importance here of youth is essential, Steve, because if we look at what youth is doing and what they want, I don't think they want war. They want to have a prosperous future for everyone. Yes.
Absolutely. So thank you again, Denise, for sharing so much with our audience and just marvelous work that you're doing and continue to do. And I look forward to meeting with you in Geneva in a few weeks. So.
Me too. Stephen, me too. Very much looking forward to seeing you in person finally, after having heard so many good things about you.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.